All right, thank you. Good morning. This is disorienting. After 2 years, we're back in person. I got to tell you, it's good to see people. And it's good to see people really. We made do with Zoom. I even did it with school kids, and some of them did okay. But so much of what we do and communicate is in person. You can tell if I'm sincere, I hope. I think I can tell if you are. So it's important. And welcome back to my board. Welcome back to the public. And cross our fingers that the combination of acquired immunity and vaccines will save enough lives and keep us going and human again. So that's my non-scripted remark. Now I go to the script. Good morning. Welcome to it's not virtual, but it's partially virtual. It's a hybrid board meeting of the California Regional Water Quality Control Board for the San Francisco Bay Region. I'm Jim McGrath. I'm chair of the board, and we'll call the roll for other board members in just a minute. But first, I want to note that today's board meeting is being conducted in accordance with COVID-19 regulations to comply with public gathering limitations. Masks are recommended, and we ask that you wear your mask when you're not speaking and respect social distancing guidelines when seated. In addition to in-person participants, we can receive public comment through a Zoom meeting platform. If you intend to comment or think you might be interested in commenting, you should already be in the Zoom meeting space. Since I'm not Zoomed, I don't know what you look like. It looks like. If you've not already received a link, you can visit our website and sign up. Please note, for today's meeting, we have technical challenges in our auditorium. That is certainly true. We had them before. And we'll only be able to hear and see and not see remote participants as noted on our website. We apologize for this inconvenience. We will try to make sure that we can see people because of what I said, that what you communicate is communicated by your body as well as your words. For those in the Zoom meeting, you will be on mute until it is your turn to speak. Our staff will then unmute you. When you are done speaking and the board members have completed asking questions, you will be placed back on mute. For all speakers, we ask that you state and possibly spell. I don't think you have to spell Smith, but you know, if it's a little bit complicated, give our record takers a break. Your name, state your affiliate organization if applicable when called upon. We appreciate your patience and understanding during these extraordinary times, and bear with us as we try to get back to in person. I'd like to now recognize Julie Haas, our executive assistant, and ask her to call the roll. Julia.
Here. Here.
Here.
I'm present. Thank you. That brings us to, I think that brings us to staff introductions. That's what it says on the sheet here. Tom? You have a new senior staff person to introduce?
Yes.
There's a time delay on all electronic communications.
I'm having difficulty hearing Tom Umley.
Okay, I'm going to call on Javier to introduce Septenay.
She's not new.
Good morning, board members. It's a pleasure seeing you today. It's my pleasure to introduce Septenay Boskert Fruit as the newest head of our climate change and TMDL section. She comes to us from the water board, where she's worked since 2012 in the planning division. So she's in actually the section that she is now going to be heading up. She studied chemical engineering at Middle East University in Ankara. Then she moved to the States and got a master's in geology at UC Santa Barbara. And then she worked 11 years in consulting for Phil Williams and Associates, which we just missed each other. I was actually an intern, and I worked with Phil Williams and Associates about 2 or 3 years before she got hired by them. And she, for Phil Williams and Associates, she worked on flood protection projects and restoration projects, and she continues to work on those restoration projects right now. She's an advisor for the Searsville Dam project for us. She also worked on the Pescadero TMDL. Plus, she's a mom of two teenagers, which keeps her pretty busy being a nurse, you know, a chef, you name it, and she does it. And now I'll turn it over to Setanai to say a few words.
Thank you, Javier. Good morning, Chair McGrath and members of the board. I am very honored to be given this opportunity to be a part of the management team and to lead the climate change and TMDL section. I have been a very lucky recipient at the Water Board to receive so much guidance and support over the years. And this is an institution whose mission I passionately believe in, and I am very excited to work with an awesome team and to start prioritizing TMDLs and water quality problems in our region and start tackling them and to develop a roadmap to climate action. Thank you.
Congratulations.
Congratulations, that's exciting.
Boy, I wish everything was that much fun. we know Satnay. I got to know her with a site tour that we did out in West Marin. And she's a very impressive woman with a great sense of humor and just great communication skills. So I'm not surprised she's been promoted, but I'm very happy about it. That brings us to the public forum. I understand we have four people. Tom, it looks like they're probably going to be on the phone line. Is that correct? All right. So first I have Mary Sackett with the Board of Supervisors. Our technical team needs to cue her up so she can talk to us. Mary, go ahead.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
You can.
Okay. Good morning. My name is Mary Sackett. I'm aide to Marin County Supervisor Damon Connolly, and I'm appearing once again on the Marinwood Plaza site cleanup in San Rafael. And just want to ask that this potentially be agendized, looking at the letter that the project owner sent to Mr. Clete Carlton on April 5th, gives me great pause, first and foremost, that it's written by the owner personally without, you know, it's no longer written by a consultant or somebody who's actually going to be doing the work. Again, giving reasons, economy, financial reasons on why things aren't happening, all of which feel as though they're falling a bit flat. And, you know, the promises that we will have an excavation and a demolition of the building and cleanup will be done this summer. I guess there's just a real concern, you know, given that this is coming from the individual and not from the consultant or the person who will be really doing the work. So ask that the board continue to monitor this closely and agendize it if you see fit. Thank you for the time.
All right. Thank you for your comments, Mary. You know, I assume that unless this is a subject that's noticed or it's going to be covered in the executive officer's report, we can't discuss it for due process reasons, but I appreciate your comments. Next up, we have Bill McNicholas. Bill's familiar to all of us. And can you cue him up? Is he ready to go? Bill? Still says Mary Sackett on the screen. All right, Bill, can you hear us?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
We can hear you, so go ahead, please.
Great. Bill McNicholas, Cleanup Marinewood Plaza, now Oversight Committee. Been here many times, as you know. I just go back is tomorrow will be marked the 8th year in which the RAP was issued back in April 14th of 2004 or whatever. And 2014, I should say. But I just went back and reviewed it. And I saw Mrs. Hoyt's letter of what she proposed to do this summer. And I'm reading the things to be done in the RAP. And in the first 6 months after the RAP was to be done, the plaza was to be torn down and remediation taken and started. 8 years later, we're still talking about the same issue we were talking about 8 years ago. What does it take to move things along and get the job done? I don't know. I've been on this for 10 years, tracking it back to when the Water District and Sue Adams said the place was cleaned up and ready for expansion, except the new project manager said, hey, you got a water, groundwater, and it's got to be taken at PCE somewhere. And we checked it across, and you guys checked it across the highway. Guess what? We found out Silvera and St. Vincent's had a nice plume going over there, and there is some work doing over there, but there's been very little except for the excavation we had back about 4 years ago, where they didn't tear down the building because of delays of getting proposals or whatever. And here we sit, same place we were 8 years ago. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, and staff members.
Thank you for comments, Bill. We understand your frustration. Pretty sure we share it. Next, we have Stephen Nestel. Stephen, can you promote Stephen, and then we can listen?
Hi. Can you hear me?
We can hear you, Stephen. Go ahead.
Okay, great. So I obviously want to endorse what Mary Sackett said, and Bill. Bill expresses the frustration that I feel, but I think actually Mary's points were well taken, that this did come from, it's really, really feels like to us that this is just a delaying tactic by the owners. And it's been enough. I'm very frustrated. I know you're frustrated. It seemed like two meetings ago, the entire board was unified that something must happen right away, and we get another delay. And I just don't know what it's going to take. It's like a boxcar stuck on the railroad tracks for our community. You know, so much is riding on this cleanup. Of course, we're interested in cleaning the water and making this area environmentally safe, but there's also several low-income housing developments that are being proposed for that site, as well as across the way at St. Vincent's. So a potential of maybe 800 units are being stopped by the recalcitrants of Marinewood Plaza LLC, and I know that they have said, well, they're in financial straits. I don't know what their financial situation is, but I will tell you that the family were the original developers of our community in the 50s and had had extensive holdings in LLCs throughout the county and possibly the rest of California. So, you know, just take what you hear with a grain of salt. Action means much more than words. Let's get it going. You have the power. Please use it. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing to our attention the April 5th letter. We were not aware of it. The vice chair and I will talk to the executive officer. We meet once a month and we set agendas down the road. So we're going to figure out when we can schedule this for a meeting, and on in what venue it would, whether it's a report or something a little more, whether it's a report or something more. So we will do that, and we will, I think, wrap in the County Board of Supervisors office so we can try to work in concert. So,
Jim, I'll just add to that if it's okay. Am I not on the right one?
You're not close enough.
Not close enough. How's that?
That's it.
Yes, it is. Okay. It sure is. Yeah. Okay. Good morning, everybody. I just want to add my, we're all frustrated by this. And when Jim says we're going to talk to the executive officer, he means, I'm sorry, Chair McGrath, he means like as soon as possible. And we're going to get this agendized as soon as possible this spring, and see what else would make sense to move this from where it is to where we would like to see it. So.
Yeah, I would to reiterate that and also just thank the commenters for their respectful and thoughtful approach to this, and that they show a tremendous amount of respect for this board, our staff, and the process. And I'm sure they have less hair than they had when they started this. I do, I know. And I hope that we can very quickly get to a point where we're taking an action to ameliorate the problem.
All right, I have one more speaker on the public forum. It's Chance Catrano from the Resource Renewal Institute. Can you promote Chance? And Chance, can you
hear me all?
We can hear you now, I think.
All right, and I can hear you all. Good morning. Thank you very much for hearing me today. Chance Catrano with the Resource Renewal Institute based in Marin County. For the last 7 years, I've been working on a program to improve landscape level ecological functions and ecological health at Point Reyes National Seashore in the Northern District of the Golden Gate National Recreation Area, which is currently under land use for cattle ranching, beef and dairy ranching. And as you know, those confined animal facilities are under WDR waivers. Back in 2021, this became an issue for your staff when a couple studies were done and fecal indicator bacteria levels were extremely high in those daily samples in the tens of thousands. And the water board response to that data was that, it was inconclusive, and that the board would need to collect samples over 6 weeks to assess water quality. And last year, Mr. Fernandez at the water board said, the water board went out there to the ranches to verify that the management measures specified in the CAF plans were being implemented and were effective. Last week, I just wanted to make you all aware that there was a report that came out about Point Reyes inspections after the public noticed some issues at some of the ranches. And it turned out that some of those ranches didn't have septic tanks, that they were allowing sewage to go straight from ranch worker housing directly into adjacent pastures and into manure ponds that would later be spread across the seashore and into adjacent water bodies. In addition to that, there are environmental justice issues related to some of that human waste, untreated sewage, just pooling under ranch worker housing that was captured by the County of Marin too. And so now there's an investigation into derelict management practices or dilapidated septic systems across the seashore. So I just wanted to bring that to your attention. And there's also a publication last week in the Point Reyes Light that there's a forthcoming study showing that people that were doing the testing followed the direction of the water board and have collected samples well over 6 weeks to help the water board assess water quality. Of course, the Park Service could and should be doing this, but the general public is raising funds to do this work to support the water board in holding folks accountable and bringing ranchers into compliance, and would really like the water board to discuss this, the Regional Water Quality Control Board, and hope to have this agendized at a future date. At the Coastal Commission hearing last week, the Coastal Commission unanimously rejected the water quality strategy that the Park Service proposed for Point Reyes National Seashore, and the Coastal Commission, a couple commissioners raised a question, where is the Regional Water Board in all of this? Why is the Park Service submitting overwhelmingly deficient plans regarding water quality? Like, we should know how to do this. It's not a new thing to regulate non-point source pollution or to regulate the confined animal facilities. So I just wanted to bring you all up to speed on this, and I hope that this can be discussed at a future meeting, and thank you all for all you do to protect water quality across the Bay Area.
Chance, thank you for your comments. We'll take this under consideration and respond at the appropriate time. It goes on the list. Thank you.
You know, we know at this point in time there's a remarkable amount of funding available to address wastewater issues. And I know the more rural and distributed kinds of systems are difficult, and funding, technical assistance and funding is not instant pudding either. But I just think we're at a point in time when within our board we have the wherewithal to help push the appropriate parties toward longer term solutions, because there is this kind of funding assistance available, and we really need to address this. So I'm looking forward to a future update. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments, questions?
Just one question. Going back to Marinwood for a second, has that April 5th letter been circulated around? Can we see the letter?
Yeah, I'll send you copies of it.
Great, thank you.
I'd certainly like to see a copy of it. I just don't want to discuss it today. All right, that brings us to the end of the public comment, the public forum, and we're up to item 3, the minutes from the March 9th, 2022 board meeting. Are there any edits to the minutes to that meeting that have been provided for you? Hearing no concerns about the draft, I would like to have a motion for approval of the minutes.
So moved.
Moved by Board Member Batty. And a second?
I'll second.
Seconded by Board Member Kissinger. Let's call the roll.
Board Member Young. Aye. Board Member Gunther.
Aye.
Board Member Hacker.
Aye.
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 Aye. That brings us to item 4, board member, the board member and chair and executive officer's report, and then we'll also hear from John McGuire. I'm going to start with Andy Gunther. Andy.
Well, I would just, like most people, I read with some sobering dismay, but not with surprise, statements summarizing the recent IPCC report about the need to mitigate climate change. And I do a lot of reading on this issue, and I'm seeing more and more frequently people saying that really the idea that we can keep the average temperature is below 1.5 degrees centigrade above historical average is already lost. And as a consequence, people can feel pretty despairing about the topic. And I just want to remind everybody that this report also says very, very clearly that we have the capacity for this not to occur. And that with every passing year now, we are seeing a situation, and I will be writing about this soon for those of you who follow my blog, where the tools to address the problem, particularly the ability to produce renewable electricity, has become cheaper and cheaper, so that solar energy is now the cheapest form of electricity in human history, and that recent economic analyses from the University of Oxford show very clearly that it is more expensive to commit to a fossil fuel powered future than it is to transition to a future based on renewable energy. And the costs that we avoid, the climate costs and the health costs, are not yet factored into that equation. So we will pay a premium straight up just for staying on fossil fuels. That's an extraordinarily powerful economic force that is beginning to roll out in our society. And the researchers at Oxford said that solar energy and wind energy are now following the same trajectory as optical fiber and transistors. And so I want everyone just to recognize that all is not yet lost by any stretch of the imagination. Moreover, if we can stop heating at 1.7 degrees centigrade instead of 1.5 degrees centigrade, we have lost something, but we've gained a lot, as opposed to its current trajectory, which looks like around 2.8. Of course, that trajectory was 4.5 10, 12 years ago. So there is change happening, and I don't want anyone to despair. It's very hard what we're looking at, but it's also possible. Thank you.
The equity benefits of the transition, I think, are clear to those that have studied it. The transition and the trajectory to become cheaper is just amazing. I don't know. I think American ingenuity is the American exceptionalism that I subscribe to. So, but I'm still an optimist. Board Member Hacker.
Nothing to add, Chair McGrath.
Thank you. Board Member Kissinger.
I'm debating whether to say anything. I'll say this. I agree with what comments were from Board Member Gunther just now, but the challenges are really formidable. You know, while solar and wind energy resources have prices have dropped precipitously, there are other dynamics in the world at work in terms of components of battery storage, which are going to be even more important in order to make the power available when it's needed. And world events are really challenging that. The material that's used for batteries, at least predominantly today, are going through the roof in terms of the price because there's such demand and the dislocation in the economy, both because of COVID and now because of what's going on in Ukraine, make those challenges that much harder. I think the one thing that's, I guess, an interesting side note from what's going on in Ukraine is that Europe will have to look for alternatives to natural gas. It is going to drive change. So I guess in that terrible situation, maybe there's some silver lining, small, but some. That's all.
Thank you, Bill. Board Member Young.
Nothing to add, sir.
Board Vice Chair Batty.
Thanks. I'm going to take us in a slightly different direction on the climate conversation. It was actually Board Member Gunther who instilled in me we all must and should do something. So I am doing some work this year. I have just been accepted into something called the Santa Cruz Mountain Stewardship Network. It has a spotlight stewardship program I think there are about 20 people in the program, and we will be visiting several different properties to talk about natural resource management and working lands management, to talk about those practices that are possible to help mitigate and battle climate change from a natural lands and working lands perspective. So we're visiting San Bruno Mountain, San Vicente Redwoods, and Glenwood Preserve. I don't know this one, Quirste Valley, Swanton Pacific Ranch and Scotts Creek, Pescadero Creek Watershed, and Los Gatos Creek Watershed. And I highlight this just only because for, you know, for my ongoing education and development around these topics, I'm looking forward to it, but also that the Santa Cruz Mountain Stewardship Network is just doing, you know, there are countless organizations like this across California that are doing really good work and continuing to educate and develop others and spread the word. So there's lots of reasons to be optimistic, even as it's terrifying. So just thought I'd share that. And Setne, I don't know where you are, if you're still here, but you might be interested in this as well. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Jane. I have nothing to add. It's been a shattering year so far in so many ways. Sean, can you promote Sean to the level where he can make a presentation? I'm told that he has a presentation for us.
Yes. Good morning, Chair McGrath. Hopefully you can hear me okay.
We can.
Great. Good to see you all. I'm very pleased to see you there in person. Regretfully, I am not there with you, and I hope I am at the next, your next board meeting in May, if not the one after that. Would love to see and meet those of you I haven't met yet in person, and I'll look forward to that discussion. We ourselves at the State Water Board just moved back to in-person meetings last week as well, and so I share your comments that you led off the meeting with, that, you know, it really is important to have that face-to-face connectivity. But, you know, at the same time, I'm definitely appreciative of the opportunity to have a hybrid way to communicate here as we go forward past the pandemic. So there's a lot going on at the state board level, you know, really statewide, as we deal with so many different water challenges. Board Member Gunther, you know, your comments about climate change resonate strongly with me as well. And I just wanted to actually share with you a bit about some of what's going on, information that's being shared with me broadly about the drought and kind of our current status. You know, I've shared information with you in the past about where we're at, and I really find it important to keep all of our regional boards in the loop as much as possible, because all of these issues are so interrelated and really do affect all of us. So if you can go to the next slide, please. I'm just going to talk briefly about the governor's executive order, which was just recently issued, a little bit about the Bay Delta drought efforts that were shared with me at the board meeting last week, drinking water, a few other actions, and then, of course, you know, I'm always available for any questions, either today at the board meeting or offline. I'm really here for you, and that's how I look at my role as your state board liaison. Next slide. So just context, I don't think there's any secrets here. This is information that's being broadcast fairly well for those who pay attention to water issues. But, you know, this is the January-February precipitation departure rankings, and basically we received no precipitation in January and February, so it shouldn't be that much of a surprise to see that we were record driest. I think if you add March to that mix, now that we have that data, we're still in the record driest condition. So it really frames, I think, what, you know, what we started the water year with, that crazy storm in October, really great December in terms of snowfall, and then nothing makes it climate whiplash really hits home with me pretty hard right now. So next slide, please. So the governor issued, because of that, because what we're seeing with the precipitation, lack of precipitation, the governor clearly felt it was important to get in front of that and issued the executive order here a couple weeks ago. And really, it's a call to everybody to say, hey, we're all in this together. We all may have varying water supply challenges, but we're on some level, you know, all connected in some way or another in terms of with water. And so we all need to work together in urban areas to limit summertime use. You'll recall that last year he asked for a 15% voluntary water savings. And we've, as a state, been tracking that at our state board meetings. And I'll say that we've had ups and downs. I think December was a really good month for us statewide. January and February, not so great. And it's probably not a surprise that, you know, when it doesn't rain, folks tend to do more outdoor watering, turn their sprinklers back on. And that's really what translates to higher water use. In the summer, of course, is our biggest demand season. And so we really need to work together here to limit that. Part of the executive order also.
John, are you still there? Or did you get?
I am still here.
Can you hear me? Some way.
Can you hear me? I'm here.
Sean, are you?
Yes,
are you still there?
I am here.
Can you hear me in the audience here? Do we have a bigger audio problem?
He can hear you. We can't hear him. I'm just going to give it 1 second. I am here.
We're standing by.
Zoom can hear Sean.
Testing.
So, Sean, we can hear you in Zoom, but the room can't hear you.
Sean, try again.
Okay, I'm still here, if you can hear me. And thanks, Elise, for confirming it's not on my end.
Of course.
Of course. For sure. As long as we're waiting 2 minutes, let's take about a five-minute break. I've been asked, but I can. I'll benefit as well. Yeah, I just decided to let it go for today.
If we can bring it back to in session, impromptu break, a little bit shorter. I think the John. Just when you thought it was safe to get back in the water. Do we hear the Jaws music now or what? I will accept that as a transient. Sean.
Yes.
I think you're back in operation. Can you continue?
I hope so. Okay. I have a number of slides here, but in the interest of time, I'm just going to hit a couple of highlights for you. And since we lost a little bit of time here. So the main takeaway here from the executive order that I think you might find interesting is for the first time, the governor has asked the state board to consider defining and then banning irrigation of non-functional turf on commercial, industrial, and institutional properties. And so that will be potentially the first time where any sort of prohibition on irrigation of those types of properties exists. And that, so that, you know, on places like parks and schoolyards and things where, you know, grass is clearly used by kids and, you know, pets and such, I mean, there's no intention whatsoever to ban irrigation of that, you know, type of property at this point. It's really just truly where areas are of grass are ornamental only and really aren't serving any other purpose at this point. So we're working through that. There's going to be a workshop coming up here, and we're asked to consider adoption of the emergency regulation at the end of May. And at the same time, we're going to think about asking all urban water systems to move to at least a level 2 of their water shortage contingency plans. And that would bring everyone to basically a mandatory within their system 15% to 20% water savings. So it should align well with the voluntary call from the governor, but also provides a lot of flexibility for each system to implement the conservation measures that they find and have found most useful for their system and have put into their own individual plans without, you know, spelling out who needs to do what exactly. And there's a number of other steps here, which I'm going to skip. So if we can go to the next slide. This just shows where we're at in terms of precipitation. And the blue line is where we are currently, although it is raining, has rained this week a bit, which is great. There is some new snow, which is good. And we're expecting some more. Unfortunately, none of that is going to push our blue line up above the shaded area, which is average. And I think even when we started the water year, there was a recognition that because we're coming off of two dry years previously, you can see the gray 2019, 2020, and 2020-21 lines there are about half of average, that we needed, you know, frankly, something much greater than average even, maybe that the pink line or the brown line up there, to really get us in a place where we're refilling our reservoirs, and have ample supply, to have just a normal year. And clearly Mother Nature has not answered that call this year. And another important thing to think about is just we don't know what the future has in store either. So we need to figure out how do we get through this year with limited water supplies, meet all of our needs, and also how do we brace for next year and just really at this point be proactive, be thinking about just a scenario where we have another repeat. We need to be ready for that and have plans in place to know what we're going to do. Next slide. So this, just another way of showing it, I think you all know, somewhere on the order of 40% of our water supply is from snowpack. And here we are, we're at 31% of average on April 1st. And that's typically when we see our maximum snowpack. And so unfortunately, we're far off from where we'd like to be on that as well. So that has raised a number of other concerns. Next slide. So when DWR came out a week and a half ago, a couple weeks ago, to do their snow survey, typically this is where you go out and measure how much snow there is. And I think I can do the measurement here. I think you can as well. There's nothing there. Maybe there is today because it has snowed a couple inches. And I think when they measured it, initially it was 1 inch of snow water equivalent, but you can imagine that with the warm temperatures that we've seen recently as well, that snowpack's not gonna last for very much longer. Next slide. So, you know, bottom line takeaway here is that we've got our reservoirs are in pretty bad shape still, that they really haven't, most of them, and the ones that are most utilized for water supply all around the state, Shasta there on the top left, and Oroville in the top middle, are really far below historical averages, and we're not expecting a lot of refill. And so that is going to trigger a whole host of additional actions here when it comes to water management. Next slide. This just shows the drought monitor. It's bad already. It was worse last summer, and I imagine that it's going to continue in this vein. Next slide. And, you know, we use all the tools that we have available to, you know, forecast, although we never have perfect foresight in terms of what's coming, but certainly the projections are for drought conditions to continue. So we need to be prepared for that. Next slide. And so what we're doing at the board when it comes to the Bay Delta watershed specifically, is that we're signaling to all of our water right holders that it's not looking great for this year, that, you know, we did pass curtailment regulations last year, emergency 1 year curtailment regulations. We sent out early warning letters in March saying that, you know, if conditions continue here as they have been, that we'll have to reinstitute curtailments again soon. We've already started that. Some of that's being held up a bit because of the precipitation that we've been seeing. But, you know, as the dry season rapidly approaches here, folks can expect that curtailments will be expanded pretty rapidly. Like I said, the regulations are 1 year duration. So we are starting to move to a process of considering some revisions to the water availability methodology that's used to determine how those curtailments work, and the regulations themselves. And so that will come up here in coming months. You may have also heard that the state and federal water projects, Bureau of Reclamation DWR, submitted a temporary urgency change petition a few weeks ago asking for changes to outflow requirements and a few other provisions here for the next few months. And our executive director issued an order on that, approving that with conditions last week. And so that process is in place. We're still going through comments. We just received comments last week. And so that it's a very dynamic situation. We're all monitoring very closely and certainly don't make those types of decisions lightly. And so that's a process that's in place right now to maintain salinity, maintain hopefully reservoir storage. And to Board Member Gunther's point about the IPCC report about temperatures, you know, we certainly have a lot of temperature challenges in our rivers, especially when reservoir conditions are as poor as they are, because we rely on them for cold water pool and managing river temperatures throughout the year. And with the situation that we have at Shasta, part of it is coming up with a plan to manage those temperatures throughout the season and balancing all of the other needs and demands on Shasta Reservoir, like water supply for agriculture, urban uses, and delta outflow. And so part of that is a temperature management plan, which this year is going to be very difficult, but that was just recently posted and has some pretty significant new water use reductions from some of the most senior water right holders in the Sacramento Valley that actually have never occurred before. So, you know, in many respects, this this year's drought, the third year of drought, really is delving deeper into our water rights system, and more cuts will be felt, and more challenging times than folks really ever have experienced in the, you know, recent decades of California water management. Next slide. And I'm just going to go through this real quick here. So what we're doing on the drinking water side is also trying to be very proactive. And so we have a number of factors that we monitor of all of our drinking water systems that our Division of Drinking Water is responsible for. And they're kind of set on three tiers right now. So you're either on or you're on a watch or a warning or an emergency stage. And if you have an emergency flag, obviously you're likely out of water. And so we're helping out those systems with bottled water or other supplies. If you're on the warning, it's likely that you've got, let's say, one supply source, like a single drinking water well, and that one's at risk of failing due to water levels. And so you're on a warning list, which means that we'd like to be in a position to be getting ready to help if that system does run short on supply. So we're tracking that and anticipate, you know, if conditions worsen this year, this list could grow, but at the same time, we're, I think, doing a much better job of keeping on top of it and being proactive rather than reactive. Next slide. This just shows the systems that we're monitoring and kind of where they are right now. I'm gonna move forward. Next slide, please. Next slide. Sorry to do this. This is just our reporting system, which has gone through some significant upgrades to track water systems and help them report critical information about their drought conditions, so we can quickly sift through all that information, given that there are several thousand systems, and make decisions quickly. Next slide. This is just another example of that data. Next slide. We have significant funding sources still available, and really the silver lining, I guess, of all of this and the situation that we're in is that funding is really not a constraint at the moment. We've got funding programs and different vehicles for drought response all over the state. This shows some of those. Next slide. We're also working with counties right now through a new program because a lot of the smallest systems and individual domestic well owners, really the jurisdiction falls with the counties. And so we're hoping that some of them step up, and we have some funding that we'd like to provide to help them spin up their programs so they can provide real on the ground assistance with tanks, water hauling, bottled water, and those types of services. So excited about that new program. Next slide. You know, at the same time, we've got a lot of infrastructure funding and really making investments. Some of these projects won't, you know, really pay dividends in the short term, you know, this year, for example, but in the longer term, these types of investments I see as critical to really building water resiliency. Next slide. And so this is just a snapshot of some of the other things that we're doing on top of all of this. We have a Salt and Sea Board workshop next week, which I'm not going to go into. We have our wastewater arrearages program. You'll recall that we have $1 billion that was tagged for arrearages coming out of the COVID pandemic. We finished the drinking water side, which was a great success. We're now accepting applications for wastewater arrearages from COVID. And that period is still open through April 22nd. So if you have permittees, POTWs that might be interested, please encourage them to apply soon. And we do have technical assistance if there are systems that need some help kind of going through that process. You'll recall that we also, from the budget last year, have $1.3 billion of state funding for water and wastewater infrastructure. And we just, at our last board meeting, adopted some intended use plan revisions to allow for that money to start going out the door quickly. And the priorities are for drinking water systems, mostly disadvantaged communities, and on the wastewater side, septic to sewer conversions. That's not to say that there aren't opportunities for all different types of projects and all different sizes of systems and conditions of systems. It just might dictate the relative priority and also how much grant versus loan you might be receiving. But very exciting and daunting at the same time, because a lot of this funding has to get out the door very quickly. And that's not the end of it. There's a lot more funding coming. We have a workshop next week on about $400 million of recycled water, groundwater cleanup funding that is also coming out of the state budget. We have additional funding for PFAS, initial investments there. And then if we turn to the federal government side, there's billions of dollars more coming, $6 billion over the next 5 years through the SRF programs, and several hundred million dollars as well for constituents of emerging concern and a number of other programs as well. So again, really exciting. And I think if you look back at the history in the 50 years since the passage of the Clean Water Act, there really has not been a time, except maybe right around then, where there's been a greater investment, intentional investment in our water infrastructure. And so it's really, you know, for me as a board member, just really great to be here and part of this. And two other items. So we also, our Division of Drinking Water released an administrative draft of the hexavalent chromium maximum contaminant level for drinking water a couple of weeks ago. And so that process is long overdue, in my opinion, and underway now. So I'm excited that is moving forward, and we'll be back in a place, hopefully, in the next year where we will have a drinking water standard for hexavalent chromium. And we're also moving forward. In fact, there was a workshop yesterday, and there's a board workshop next week on the construction stormwater general permit. And that has been in process for several years now as well. So that, I think, will be coming to a close here with possible board consideration of adoption within the next couple of months. So next slide. So I'll leave it at that. As you can see, lots going on. So there's a lot, I'm so excited to share with you all. Big problems, big challenges that we have, certainly, but a great team overall. And I think we're, you know, hopefully moving in the right direction in the long term. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Sean. Are there any board member questions? Jane?
I have just a quick question. Sean, or maybe Tom, I'm not sure who. When it comes to drought, could you talk a little bit about the role of the regional boards in how we can support this work or further your efforts to communicate on the topic. I think I probably speak for all of us when I say I'd also love a copy of your slides, because I get these questions all the time from people. So if we could make those available. But what, can you talk about the role of the regional boards in supporting this work around drought?
Sean, you?
Yeah, so I'll give it a shot. So yeah, Vice Chair Batty, certainly great question. And I hear that, hear your question similarly from a lot of regional boards that I work with. And I think the answer is that, you know, you don't really have direct oversight over drinking water issues or water rights allocation decision-making. But you know, it's times like this where communication becomes critically important. You know, you have dischargers who are looking at recycled water, investing in indirect potable reuse, you know, taking other actions. And I really hope, you know, you can help spread the word about these opportunities, about the needs that are out there, and help connect. You know, if you learn about folks that are having challenges, that you can, we can connect them to our, you know, our water rights folks or drinking water folks. Because it really is a small water community at the end of the day. And so I don't look at for you as a lot of responsibility or decision-making that you need to take in the short term. But again, it's all about relationships here. I don't know, Tom, if you have anything to add.
Yeah, thanks, Sean. And I would say for myself that I hope that the Water Board, that we all can have the tools. We know we will hear from community members because of the name of the organization. They won't know that it's not our direct responsibility. So it'd be great if we have the communication tools and the information so we can at least share and know where to send people for a deeper level of information.
Yes. That's a great point. I will definitely get you the slides and also make sure that you've got that kind of a quick cheat sheet, if you will, of contact information and know where to send folks. That's exactly why I'm here.
I don't.
Let's try this one. Yes. Okay. Well, my response is pretty much the same as Sean's, that we don't have any direct role other than communication, and you know, we can partner with the promoting the state board's efforts, and we do have eyes and ears that can be an asset. So that's how I look at it. I mean, we are with funding, with these funding opportunities at hand, including monies for water infrastructure and the like, which will include recycle water project opportunities. We do have a stake in that because a lot of that obviously directly relates to wastewater facilities that we regulate. And so we will have opportunity to promote and support those type of projects as part of a drought response, if you will. But we're mostly indirect, but it's we're all hands on deck. We'll do everything we can.
Yes, hi, Lisa Horowitz McCann, Assistant Executive Officer. Just wanted to add, our sustainable groundwater management team does track and work with local agencies on maintaining their basins, both for water quality, water supply, and does interact with State Board and Department of Water Resources as those roles are established in SGMA on those basins.
Sean, this is Alexis. I just had a question about one of your earlier drinking water slides. For the 9 systems that are presently being supplied with hauled water, do we know of a medium to longer term plan to put in place a more lasting solution?
Oh, yeah, a great question. Absolutely. Yeah, we work with all of these systems that are experiencing challenges. And, you know, we call all these interim solutions in terms of, we don't want anyone on bottled water or water hauling for the long haul. So we provide technical assistance to them. So there's a number of technical assistance providers, and they work on developing long-term water supply strategies. So I don't have specific knowledge of the timeline for each of those systems, but I know they are working closely and trying to get a long-term solution in place quickly.
Thank you.
All right, I'd like to move us along a little more quickly now. I almost said Bruce, Tom, it's your turn for the executive officer's report. Please.
Well, yeah, well, thank you. I'll just briefly note a couple highlights in the report. Noteworthy, we do an update on a significant cleanup effort at the Manisha Industrial Park. Noteworthy is that we have now seen the wineries are starting to enroll in the general order, which we had a major stake in the development over multiple years. A key accomplishment just recently is the approval of the San Mateo County Local Agency Management Program. That's really, it's really, we're relying on the counties to be the front line for regulating septic systems, on-site systems, and it's built into the state's policy on these systems as a way of, we don't have to directly regulate them if sites are being managed via an approved local agency management plan. So it's kind of a key accomplishment that this is happening. I think noteworthy for many of you that we are paying attention to, but we have wastewater facilities who are part of this ongoing wastewater surveillance for COVID around the country, but certainly in California and the state. And so we draw attention to that and provide a link if people want to have access to a portal where information is being made readily available. The key to that is that we're obviously the source system knows what's happening faster than anything else. And it's a really good indicator of what may be happening coming forward. If there's a wave, it will show up in the wastewater before it probably becomes noticeable otherwise. And the other side too, showing downward trends have been observed, so that's cool. So I'll end with just calling to your attention that a major milestone is achieved by staff this week. On Monday, we public noticed the revised tentative order for the municipal regional stormwater permit, and public noticed the hearing, which will be at the board meeting on May 11th. And so that's a major effort. It's a significant package and we've made revisions in response to comments and fixed a few things that we obviously found, but a major effort, and will result in a significant probably hearing in May. There will be I think you should anticipate it being a long day, but we discussed with Chair and Vice Chair, we feel confident it can be handled in one day. And so that's been public notice as such.
It will be a long day. Make sure that you can be here. Tolerate me when I try to hurry people along, because we can do it in a day if we put our minds to it.
Can we define a long day? I have my calendar application open.
We're looking at probably at least 4 o'clock.
Thank you.
It could be 6. I'll do my best. I get hungry too, you know. And that concludes, just to note, you've got a little paper there about rising groundwater. It kind of ties into what you see in the executive officer's report about the recent work by Christina Hill. At some point, we want to get people like that into closer communication with us so they understand what we're doing. That's why I provided it to you.
Jim, can I just note for Tom?
Sure.
I really appreciated the graph in the report that showed the spike as determined by our wastewater system. And as I was driving in today, I heard a report on the radio about differences between counties using wastewater data. And so I really think that this is a great example of us being part of this public health response.
Thank you.
Noteworthy is our Bay Area municipal wastewater folks are and be fairly progressive and always willing to engage in these, pushing the envelope on things, willing to do the extra sampling, et cetera, to be party to this effort. So it's noteworthy.
All right, I'm going to do the swearing in at this point. All relevant evidence that any person desires to be considered by this board must be introduced at this hearing, first by the board staff, second by the discharger, third by public agencies, and fourth by any other interested persons. The board and board counsel may ask questions to clarify the testimony of a witness at any time. Cross-examination of any witness by others will be allowed following completion of direct testimony by all persons. Each person testifying will commence by stating his or her name, whom he or she represents, and whether he or she took the oath to tell the truth. The hearings will not be conducted according to technical rules of evidence. The board will accept any evidence or testimony that is reasonably relevant to the issues. All board files, exhibits, and agenda materials pertaining to this matter will be made part of the record of this proceeding. Additional written material will be made part of the record at the discretion of the board. Those wishing to testify in the hearing will now rise or raise their hands. Do you promise to tell the truth? All right. This brings us to our uncontested agenda, item 5. There are 3 items on that: the Highway 237 landfill updating waste discharge requirements, the Lake Parcel landfill waste discharge requirements, and the Oregon Expressway underpass. Tom, did you see a need for any presentation on any of these beyond the reports that you have?
No.
Are there any questions by any of the board members on any of these 3 items? I'm seeing Andy. Go ahead.
So the Highway 237 project, Tom, it says that WDRs are being updated to reflect changes in ownership. And I just wanted to ask about the long-term stewardship of these kinds of situations. Does the hotel and office center project, do they also own the landfill? And are they the ones who, if there's a problem, we engage with? Or might the landfill be owned by a trust that lives in, that is centered in Philadelphia or something? And I just wondered about if a response is necessary, right? Or if let's say they're not providing the updated information about how they're going to address sea level rise, do we know whose door we knock on to talk about this?
Hi, my name is Nate Peel. I'm in the Groundwater Protection Division and specifically the Land Disposal Section, and I'm the case manager for the Highway 237 landfill. To answer your question, there is a management agency that specifically is organized around complying with the WDR requirements. So that agency or board, I'm not like a business person, so I don't know the technical term for how the group organizes itself, but on the WDR is listed both that agency and other dischargers that own the specific properties. So they're all bound into complying with the requirements, but specifically the one management agency is responsible for like doing the monitoring reports. They're the people that we interface with when there's questions about monitoring issues. Is that kind of what you're asking?
Well, yeah, and so the and that agency is exists in perpetuity, in essence. I guess we don't need too much more time. Maybe you guys can just in a subsequent EO report or something. I mean, if somebody goes bankrupt, then what happens? I'm trying to understand, so many times it appears to me that long-term management situations like this result in the ultimately the taxpayers kind of being on the hook if certain kind of legal things evolve. And I'm wondering if we can avoid that, and maybe my dear colleague Alexis can give you even more information about that.
I know Yuri will add something, but I think if you look at item 20 on financial assurance, it depends on what the nature of that instrument is. And so staff could get back to us in general on what are some of the more typical ways that these entities provide financial assurance. And I was going to ask, how do we ensure that it gets updated to reflect the increased costs from one permit cycle to another? But it just depends on the instrument. Any LLC that we see here as an owner can similarly be disestablished, right? And so through a sale or through other reasons, it doesn't mean that we have these LLCs in perpetuity as well. But Yuri, you were going to add something.
I was just going to say exactly what you said, that there's financial assurances. And I do believe that they have to be updated, but I'm not certain, so I can't speak to that. But we can certainly get back to you on that issue.
There is a requirement for them to be updated every 5 years.
Okay, thank you.
And Board Member Guthrie, let me just add that this is part of our responsibility is to make sure waste discharge requirements are up to date. And they don't expire like NPDES permits by law expire after 5 years. Waste discharge requirements don't expire, but we have a responsibility to review them on a regular basis and update them accordingly. So that's it's so we have to start, we set program priorities and make sure that we do keep them up to date. Given you know, given the nature of these type of sites, and especially if there's any concern about lingering contamination, and anything that may be adversely affected by climate change, and like we have need to turn up our vigilance, if you will. But that's normal business, is that we stay on top of these things, and there are situations where we run into bankruptcy challenges, and that's when we. You know, we look for legal counsel and how we play our cards in terms of what stake do we have in any resolution of bankruptcy. But it doesn't make responsibility go away per se, because it always will stay with, to a degree, with land ownership. So if that's one of the challenges, if a site that's being owned by somebody goes bankrupt, then that's a vulnerability in terms of who will take over that site, because taking over the site will come with responsibility for managing it. So the banks often are on the ball on this one as well, because they don't like any liability associated with a contaminated site becoming their liability. So that's where they weigh in a lot on cleanup sites to our advantage.
So I'd like to curtail this a little bit. While it's an important discussion to anticipate the aging of an asset, this was an extensively engineered facility, which included moving waste in order and providing the necessary barriers. At some point, in the renewal cycle, I think you have to anticipate that an asset might lose value over time, or there might need to be some type of rethinking. But in something that is just the update for the change in ownership, I don't want to get too far down into the weeds on this one. Lisa, you want me to go at least a little more into the
weeds? I wanted to respond to the other part of Board Member Gunther's question about the sea level rise vulnerability and assessment requirements. So for landfill, for the Highway 237 landfill, we chose to delay putting that requirement into this permit because we're on the cusp of having a general requirement for all landfills that don't already have that requirement that will be more up to date and vetted in collaboration with the landfills and landfill owners and scientists and good policy. So you can see that in a couple months. The other landfill already has the requirement from the past. So we have both of these landfills are covered for that requirement and expectation.
Are you good, Andy?
I'm good for now, Jim.
Okay, well, and I want you to be alert. Are there questions on any of the other two items?
Hearing none.
Can I have one real fast
one? You may.
On the oh no, I'm sorry. I'm on the wrong item.
Can I have a motion to approve the uncontested calendar?
You may, from me.
Moved by Board Member Gunther, and a second
from second.
Board Member Young. Can we call the roll, please?
Yes. Aye.
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 Aye. So ordered. I could bang the gavel if I wanted to be like Terry. That brings us to item six, the Lynn Tuggan barge renewal of the waste discharge requirements. I believe we've got looks like there's a presentation. I see staff coming up.
So I'll cue this item up. This will be a standard hearing. We have a staff presentation followed by the interaction with board if you have questions, and then we will have other speakers providing testimony. But with that, I'll call on Selena Louis to give the staff presentation.
Good morning, Board Chair McGrath and members of the board. I am Selena Louis from the Planning and TMDL Division. And today I will be presenting agenda item six, which would issue waste discharge requirements and a 401 water quality certification for oyster shell mining in South San Francisco Bay. Oyster shells have been mined commercially from the South San Francisco Bay since 1924. The oyster shells are primarily used as a mineral and nutrient supplement in poultry and livestock diets. In 1974, the Water Board permitted Pioneer Shell Company dredging to mine oyster shells. The company was purchased and eventually became Lynn Tug and Barge, the current permittee, which I'll refer to as Lynn. Lynn applied to continue oyster shell mining operations in South San Francisco Bay, so we are proposing updated waste discharge requirements and a water quality certification in order to protect water quality and support the bay's beneficial uses. The project's location is shaded in red on this map, and I will refer to it as the lease area. This lease area is approximately 1,560 acres. Lynn proposes to dredge up to 80,000 cubic yards of oyster shells annually. The permit includes monitoring of the discharge and the receiving water, minimization measures to avoid possible impacts, as well as compensatory mitigation for unavoidable impacts. We will talk about each of these later. Next slide, please. Let's talk about the oyster shell mining method and equipment. Here is a picture of the equipment from the perspective of the tugboat driver. Oyster shell mining is conducted using a hydraulic dredge method, essentially sucking up the material like a straw. The shell dredge, pictured on the right, mines the shells and sediment and then pumps the oyster shell slurry into the trommel where the silt and water falls off the shells. After that, the conveyor belt transfers the shells into the barge. The filling of a barge is considered one mining episode in the order. Next slide, please. Here is a schematic diagram of the tugboat and shell dredge from the side. Mining occurs 2 to 3 feet below the mud surface. Bay water is sucked into the suction pipe above the mud to facilitate the formation of the oyster shells and silt slurry. Bay water is also used to wash the silt off the shells. Since there may be entrainment of endangered or threatened species, such as steelhead, green sturgeon, and longfin smelt, the National Marine Fisheries Services, or NOAA Fisheries, and the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, or CDFW, require fish screens as entrainment mitigation measures. Next slide, please. The California Environmental Quality Act, or CEQA, requires the lead agency of a project to prepare an appropriate environmental document. For this project, the State Lands Commission is the lead agency. It prepared a mitigated negative declaration, or NEGDEC for short, prior to renewing the mineral extraction lease. State Lands adopted the NEGDEC and renewed the lease in 2018. State Lands will start working on the next CEQA process in 2026, 2 years ahead of Lynn's lease expiration date. The NEGDEC includes monitoring requirements directed at the Water Board to include in its future permit for Lynn. As the name implies, a mitigated negative declaration includes mitigation measures that have been incorporated for this project to minimize impacts to less than significant levels. In the following slides, I will describe the monitoring requirements, the mitigation measures, and the compensatory mitigation requirements we included in this order. Next slide, please. As I mentioned before, a slurry of shells, water, and silt is mined. The water and silt are returned into the bay to ensure protection of the beneficial uses of San Francisco Bay. This order requires discharge and receiving water monitoring. Discharge water is monitored for flow rate, turbidity, and pH. Receiving water is monitored for turbidity, pH, and dissolved oxygen at different distances downcurrent of the discharge, and also a control sample taken upstream of the discharge. The receiving water monitoring requirements are consistent with the NEGDEC's monitoring requirement to characterize the discharge plume. Next slide, please. The order incorporates requirements to minimize impacts to water quality to less than significant levels. These include measures described in the NEGDEC and are consistent with CDFW's and NOAA Fisheries requirements. The first measure is to limit shell mining to no more than 80,000 cubic yards per year to minimize disturbance of estuarine and special status species habitat. There are multiple measures to minimize fish entrainment from the water intake process, such as fish screens. The next measure is to cease mining for 2 months between February 1st and June 30th each year to minimize impacts to spawning and rearing habitat of special status fish species, including the longfin smelt. Another measure is to discharge silt and water to the bay through a subsurface pipe to minimize turbidity. Next slide, please. The order also includes two new minimization measures which are needed to protect receiving waters and beneficial uses. The first measure limits the discharge of silt and water to the lease area to minimize risk to sensitive aquatic species located outside of the lease area. The second measure limits the shell mining area to no more than 75% of the total lease area each year to minimize disturbance to the benthic communities. Lastly, the order incorporates two compensatory mitigation measures, which are consistent with requirements from CDFW and our NOAA Fisheries. The first measure is the purchase of 0.2 acres of mitigation credits to compensate for unavoidable impacts to special status species habitat, such as longfin smelt and green sturgeon. Pictured in the background is Liberty Island Conservation Bank, where Lynn purchased the mitigation credits. The second measure requires Lynn to provide 3% of the oyster shell mine for shoreline restoration projects around the bay. We worked with NOAA Fisheries and other agencies to develop this compensatory mitigation measure. As with all permits, this permit also requires an annual report to update us on mining activities. Each annual report will include results from the monitoring conducted on the discharge and the receiving water. It will also provide information on the mining episodes to better characterize the scope of the project. This information includes maps showing areas mined and the volume of shells mined. In addition, this order requires a special study to evaluate how the mining activity may have off-site or indirect effects. The special study is focused on determining whether shell mining affects shell transport and contributes to erosion of shell beaches and shoals. If erosion is happening, it would result in impacts to water quality and beneficial uses. Based on current information, we do not believe that mining of oyster shells will reduce the amount of shell available to maintain hash beaches on the shorelines, but there is sufficient uncertainty to warrant further analysis. The tentative order therefore required Lynn to complete a special study to assess whether mining oyster shells could contribute to shell hash beach erosion in San Mateo County. Specifically, the tentative order required Lynn to compare the composition and age of the sediment and shells mined from the bay to composition and age of the sediment and shells at 1, the Outer Bear Island Shell Hash Beach, 2, a shell hash beach in Foster City, and the shoals adjacent to these beaches. Next slide, please. Next, I will talk about the comments we received on the tentative order. The tentative order was circulated for a 30-day public comment period. We received 16 comment letters, 15 were in support of adoption, and included letters from Lynn, the applicant, as well as agricultural feed manufacturers, suppliers, and distributors, and also small flock farmers. San Francisco Baykeeper and Citizens to Complete the Refuge submitted a joint comment letter. They raised concerns regarding the inadequacy of the special study to assess the indirect impacts of mining, as well as other comments, including the volume of shells dredged, the months mining is curtailed, and the compensatory mitigation measures. I will go over their comments in the following slides. Next slide, please. The commenters stated that the special study would not assess the project's indirect impacts on the shell beaches. In response to their comments, we added a requirement for a technical advisory committee known as a TAC to develop and oversee the special study work plan. We also expanded the scope of the special study to better understand potential off-site impacts. We removed the specific requirement to date shells, but we added a requirement to more broadly characterize the shell material from hash beaches, submerged shoals, and the mining area. Second, we clarified that the TAC should focus on the management question to identify the relationship between the mining activities and the erosion at the beaches using tools such as a tracer study or other methods as identified by the TAC. Because we expanded the scope of the special study and required a TAC, we extended the due date of the final report submittal by about 1 year. Next slide, please. Baykeeper and Citizens to Complete the Refuge had other comments. I'll highlight a few of them at this time. The first comment asked us to expand the mining curtailment to between January and March each year to better protect the spawning of longfin smelt. Longfin smelt is protected by CDFW, and that agency determined that a 2-month curtailment of mining between February 1st and June 30th each year is appropriate to protect spawning. We concur with CDFW. Therefore, we did not make the requested change, but we did revise the order to require Lynn to notify the Water Board each year of the 2 months it will not dredge. Another comment stated that it is unclear how the 0.2 acres of compensatory mitigation was calculated. CDFW has expertise in the life cycle of longfin smelt, and it calculated the compensatory mitigation based on impacts to longfin smelt spawning. We evaluated this compensatory mitigation and worked with NOAA Fisheries to identify additional compensatory mitigation for impacts to estuarine habitat not covered by the mitigation for longfin smelt. Based on our coordinated evaluation of impacts and mitigation needed to offset these impacts, we believe that the compensatory mitigation offsets impacts to special status species habitat and estuarine habitat in general. Therefore, we did not revise the order to require additional mitigation. We added a requirement to compare the three bathymetric surveys per the request and added a requirement to compare the surveys over time to evaluate changes in bay floor elevation and the volume of historic shells available. Last, we did not reduce the annual mining maximum of 80,000 cubic yards because the current evidence from the neg deck does not show the mitigation measure is inadequate. Actual dredge volumes depend on market demand, and the permittee averaged less than 60,000 cubic yards over the past 10 years. So actual dredging is well below this annual maximum. Next slide, please. We recently noticed one typographical error in the revised tentative order that needs to be changed to reflect the intended reporting timeframe for the special study. On page 17, provision 6, sub-bullet B, following the work plan shall also, it should be revised to state, include a schedule for completing the special study and submitting the final report for the special study, which shall be submitted to the executive officer for approval within 4 years of adoption of this order. This revision is consistent with the text in finding 16 and the text in our response to comments. The proposed change is shown in bolded text with 3 struck out and the 4 underlined. Next slide, please. This picture shows a shell hash beach directly west of the oyster shell mining area. In summary, this order requires mitigation, water quality monitoring, and a special study to protect water quality and bay beneficial uses. This concludes my presentation. I'm happy to answer any questions the board may have at this time.
So are there questions from the board? Andy, go ahead.
Thanks. Thanks for the presentation. I have really questions. First, I really appreciate the special condition that seeks to link shell mining with using this material for shoreline restoration. That's a very thoughtful approach, and I would like to even ask that it be considered expanded to also to the concept of shoreline resilience. Now, maybe that's implied, but many I know of the plans that I've seen have a component of a natural reef or something. And this material, I mean, I don't know if Kathy Boyer's using some of this stuff to try and make her reefs or what, but I think it's a great way for the permittee to be involved in a multi-benefit approach, which I really like. I would also like to point out that for the TAC, for this study, I understand if I read this correctly, that the TAC will take on a management question and figure out how to do a study and to address this. And I would just like if the EO has to approve this, to consider that the ability of the TAC to address the management question will be heavily influenced by whether the group and those who are going to be reviewing the tax work can agree ahead of time about what certain quantitative changes might mean. So otherwise, you have the classic problem where the scientists do the study and they produce their 95% confidence limits, but on this item that we measured, well, so what? And so to have it be effective, and particularly if I understand this issue where we're talking about transport and engagement across remote places that are remote from each other in San Francisco Bay, is a very complicated question. Or at least be ready when this comes back up to not necessarily know the answer. So those are two points I'd like to bring up. But in particular, I really applaud Lynn and the staff who've put together this idea that this material can be used in a non-traditional way to really advance public benefit in the region. And I hope we continue to find ways to do that.
So I'm head of planning division. Agree with Andy on all of those points. We were trying to identify a specific location for sending the oyster shells and working with National Marine Fisheries Service and BCDC, Bay Conservation Development Commission on this. And we couldn't identify one particular site right away, but we identified multiple potential sites such as Foster City, where they would actually use it for beaches, and that is specifically for resilience. It would reduce the wave fetch and allow them to build their seawall a little lower. Also, we looked at the South Bay Salt Pond project, where they have about 500 linear feet that they're looking at potentially doing a pilot project to help with, again, wave energy as part of a restoration project. So we're definitely looking at resilience as part of it and not just restoration. And then as far as the TAC and the difficult question, completely agree on all fronts, including agreeing upon what the decision points are and what are our decision errors that we're willing to live with. Thanks.
Board Member Guthrie, I'd just like to emphasize that last point, because as you know from working with me, we don't want to require science that's not used. It's almost worse than no science, because we've wasted money. So we have a strong interest in making sure that these studies are as good as they can be, and they'll provide information beyond just this order's need. Additional information on bay bathymetry in that area is going to be valuable asset to our ongoing effort to improve understanding of sediment movement and transport in the bay. So we'll be on it, because we're really good at asking the so what question. We want to make sure results translate into information that can be used to make management decisions. So we take that responsibility seriously.
Young, did you have a question?
I did, thank you. Am I too loud? Sorry, first time on the microphone here. I just had a couple of logic questions. Could you restate why the mining for 2 months wasn't contiguous?
Yes, it is Javier Fernandez again, with the head of planning division. The reason why it's not contiguous is because the spawning period for longfin smelt can vary from year to year depending on conditions.
Okay, so they're going to align with that, not of their own sort of volition, correct?
Right. Okay. So the 2 months are likely going to be contiguous, but whether it's February, March, or March, April, that varies, because when they start spawning, rainfall has a big factor, and it just changes from year to year. So we want to make sure that we get the 2 months where they're actually spawning and not just some random 2 months where they may or may not be spawning.
Understood. And then the second one is 80,000 cubic yards, but I heard that they're really well within that and they don't necessarily ever go that high. Is there a reason that we're not capping it where they're really performing?
Their highest has been 76,000 cubic yards. And so 80,000 cubic yards,
it's close.
It's,
I know.
Close. I'm just, round.
And I guess I'm trying to make sure I understand the intensity. That's all. The intensity of what? Because now we're talking about 10 months of the operation for 80,000, which they're probably already doing anyway to some degree. But I just want to make sure that the intensity can be understood. It's obviously, I don't think it's a hyperbolic curve, but within 10 months, if you just did the math, 8,000 per month. That's all I was trying to understand. So thank you.
Yeah, so we are also trying to understand that better. So we have reporting requirements now that weren't in the previous order that is not being rescinded, so that we can get a better understanding of their mining activities, the frequency, the locations. We're requiring maps now so we can see where they're actually mining, as well as the volumes. They haven't been mining for a couple years now because they haven't had permits to do so from other agencies. So we anticipate initially, at least, there's going to be a high demand. So initially they may reach that 80,000 cubic yards, but then subsequent years they are likely going to be under.
All right, if that completes the questions, I have two cards from the applicant who have offered to respond to questions, but I do see that Ian Wren is in the Zoom audience, and I know Ian represents Baykeeper, and I wanted to make sure that if he wanted to make a comment, he had the opportunity to do so. I don't see any raised hands in the virtual side, but I want to make sure that we give him a minute to raise his hand. There it is. He's up.
All right.
Ian, how did I know you might have a comment? Can you promote Ian so he can speak? And Ian, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. I think I'm on.
We can hear you too. All right. Go ahead.
All right. Good morning. My name is Ian Wren, and I'm speaking on behalf of San Francisco Baykeeper and Citizens Committee to Complete the Refuge. I apologize for not being able to be present in person, but I wanted to convey comments prepared by Karen High, who I believe several of you are familiar with, given her dedication to the Bay. I might go a minute or so over, but please hope you understand. Our organizations have submitted several public comments letters regarding the longstanding failure to assess whether in-bay oyster mining directly and cumulatively impacts the shell sediment budget and shell transport rates that sustain important subtidal, intertidal, shell bar, and beach habitats. We appreciate changes made thus far by staff. However, we urge the board to incorporate a few clarifying edits to the language of the draft tentative order that will not alter the scope of the proposed special study, but should instead focus that study on collecting key evidence necessary to generate evidence-based decisions for the next permit cycle. We suggest the following changes to the language of the TO. First, provision 6 on page 8 currently reads, does shell harvesting affect shell transport and thus contribute to erosion of shell beaches and shoals in the South Bay? We suggest that the management questions be revised to, does oyster shell harvesting affect shell transport and thus contribute to erosion of shell beaches and shoals through the significant interruption or loss of net sediment transport and sediment budgets that maintain bars and beaches? We ask this to provide more specificity to the question and more narrowly focus the relatively small amount of funding afforded for the special study, as well as the difficulties of relying on attack as alluded to by Dr. Gunther and Dr. Mumley. Secondly, in finding 6C at page 8 and provision 6C on page 17, we urge that the word or be struck from the statement that reads, the analysis may include assessing mobility and transport of shells within the mining area using a tracer study and or by measuring wave energy, shear stress, storm surge, and other important factors that can affect mobilization and transport of shells shoreward. We ask this because without key sediment budget data on the rate, volume, and direction of shell transport, no amount of modeling or background data collection will provide adequate regulatory science support. We are currently extremely concerned that indirect modeling without the benefit of actual data will yield inconclusive results and thus result in further delays in obtaining information necessary for informed regulatory decision making in the next permit cycle. Finally, worries remain that the direct impacts of oyster shell mining on beneficial uses of the bay, specifically shellfish resources, are still not being examined directly at all. The board is continuing to permit oyster mining without determining whether live native oysters are recolonizing shell veneers left in the mining areas. And we know oysters do colonize their own dead shells in bars and veneers, providing significant or sufficient biological evidence to justify direct surveys for live oyster colonization of shell surfaces and veneers in the mining area. We encourage staff to consider inclusion of such monitoring to avoid a situation where the next permit decision remains assumption-driven, as previous permits have over the last several decades. Thank you for allowing these comments, and I understand this is a non-traditional request to make changes on the fly, but these are relatively minor, and I would be happy to transmit these to staff immediately. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Tom, do we have anyone else commenting today, or is that? Yes, one more. Hold on. You're taking a look. Well,
we are familiar with those requests. Staff, we're engaged with Ian, and so we'll be able to respond once testimony is completed.
Okay, I have two cards here.
So those two are just for just from the. From the company, if you have questions.
If we have questions, so that was the only speaker.
Let me just confirm. I think we actually, that is all of the speaker cards for the item. But we did have a couple other submittals, Charles Hansen and Chris Zanabini.
If anyone's on the line and wants to
do we have those?
Address it all. Panelists? Please raise your hand. Okay, we have one. I'm not seeing anyone else. The hand raised. Ian, Chris has his hand raised. Yeah, okay, go ahead. Chris, are you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, we've got you, Chris. Thanks.
Okay, Chris Zanobini, my last name spelled Zanobini. And I am the CEO of the California Grain and Feed Association. A little bit about our organization. We've been around since 1924. And represent the grain and feed industry in California and the better part of the West Coast. 220 members. We represent about 95% of the feed volume in the state of California. Our industry feeds animal agriculture industry, including the egg industry, which produces about 60% of the eggs consumed in California under some of the strictest production requirements in the country and the world. And that 60% is what is produced in California for consumption in California. Just a little tidbit, eggs are the highest quality protein at the lowest cost, important source for a very large sector of our population. And almost all eggs produced in California and the West Coast are for the table market, or for example, whole eggs. And I'll get to that in a minute. We're in support of the order. Oyster shell is very important product for animal agriculture in California, in particular the poultry industry and egg-laying hens. It is the best and most reliable source of calcium in poultry feed, specifically in laying hens, and a preferred source of calcium for backyard hens. Oyster shell has actually two products. In the process, you end up with oyster shell and then oyster flour. And different particle sizes are extremely important aspect of a healthy diet. And in particular, oyster shell is a preferred particle size over substitute products and provides a better feed mixture for egg-laying hens. It's also important to note, it is the only source and preferred source of calcium for organic egg production. A lack of oyster shell has forced the organic egg producers to use a substitute product, which is a mined mineral and not considered to be preferred in organic production. And then oyster shell is very porous and has a larger surface area, which relates to a more efficient source of calcium for feed. I'm aware that in the some of the comments, there was a study or some comments provided about using eggshell as an option or substitute for oyster shell. And I wanted to speak a little bit to that. Number one, there's no processing or breaker egg industry on the West Coast, and it's really not feasible to ship eggshell across the country. And there is a very large egg industry in the Midwest that would consume that product if it actually were a reliable source of calcium. Problems with eggshells as feed, there's a high probability of salmonella contamination and the potential to spread other diseases, which is a very significant concern. It's also difficult to process due to the membrane and the albumin in the shell, requires significant heat treatment to break down, and really not the best source of calcium per surface unit. And that product would have to be shipped halfway across the country if it was to even be utilized. So just to recap, oyster shell is definitely needed, and hence why we support this project. It is the highest quality, most efficient source of calcium for animal feed, naturally occurring. It is the only organic product for calcium source, and it really is needed for eggshell strength and overall poultry health. And with that, I will answer any questions.
Chris, thank you for your comments. I'm going to turn to staff in just a second and ask for your thoughts on Baykeeper's input, but I just have to say, as a chicken wrangler myself, I appreciate the oyster shell need. So thank you for your work, Chris, and I'll go back to staff.
Thank you, Jane. Javier Fernandez, the head of planning division. We looked at Baykeeper's comments. First, I think we'll address, we're going to start with the recruitment of oysters on shell hash and the comments on essential fish habitat. That is why we required mitigation in the form of oyster shells, 3% of their oyster shells, up to 1,800 cubic yards annually for the shoreline restoration projects. That was working with National Marine Fisheries Service, who looks at essential fish habitat, and that's where that mitigation was determined. We didn't feel the need to do additional studies since we're requiring mitigation for it. And then in regards to the additional language on page 17 under provision 6, I believe it's, does oyster shell harvesting affect shell transport and thus contribute to erosion of shell beaches and shoals in South San Francisco Bay through significant interruption or loss in net sediment transport and sediment budgets that maintains bars and beaches? It makes it longer, but we don't see that it actually alters the requirement very, very much. So we would recommend accepting it with one slight change, and that is to remove significant. So what we would recommend is to revise the language to say, does oyster shell harvesting affect shell transport and thus contribute to erosion of shell beaches and shoals in South Bay through interruption or loss in net sediment transport and sediment budgets that maintains bars and beaches?
That's everything.
I believe that was everything.
Okay, great.
So, Jane, I'd like to make a comment.
Yeah.
This is actually one of the issues that I've studied for any number of years. And as some of you know, I'm not a giant fan of sand mining, but I do recognize that our society uses concrete, and you need to have sustainable sources. This area, I spent about 20 years on the board of the San Francisco Board Sailing Association, which is a group that uses many of these beaches. And in that work, I've looked at the changes that have occurred off here. I'm going to support the staff recommendation for two basic reasons. First of all, this is well offshore. And if you've got material which is settling out without extensive settling, it's big particles. It's not going to be moving in the wave climate that's there. So the material out here is relic material. Some material will settle back in. It'll be fine grain material, but it's a different process than that which is active at the beach. So that's the first conclusion that I have, is that the risk is low. The second conclusion is this shoreline is so modified and so trashed and so at risk that the long-term solutions for resilience are of a much larger scale than this 80,000 cubic yards of borrowing material or of extracting material. Coyote Beach, and the material on this was developed by Moffett and Nickel as part of the look at Coyote Point and the beaches there. Not too long ago, they looked at the historic development of these beaches. They kind of started by bulldozing all the dunes, which were relic dunes of old age, out onto the beach to make a racetrack. And that's deteriorated. If you go down to the Bear Island area, the kinds of changes are not even very well documented, but the erosion hazard that exists independently of this. It may be in part a product of different sand mining and shell mining activities over the last 150 years, but there's really no way of knowing. The solutions are going to be of a very substantially greater magnitude, and the AA effort, Measure AA, the Restoration Authority, knows that San Mateo County is more at risk and is working on it, as is our staff. So I think the staff got it right, but I wanted to make sure that there was a clear record that the risk is low. This will add to our understanding that even if it had a risk, that risk compared to the scale of what needs to be done to have a sustainable shoreline here is minor. And so I'm going to support the staff recommendation.
I think I'm going to make sure board, any other comments from board members? But great, Javier?
I recognize that I missed one of their comments, okay. And that was the request to revise the language to remove an or. And essentially that would require a tracer study and measuring wave energy. We do not recommend removing the or because we're not sure a tracer study can be done there. We're talking about gravel-sized shell particles mixed in cohesive sediments. And, you know, tracer studies that were brought up as examples were mostly in coarse sediment and in sand. And so that mixture, we feel, is quite complex and may not lend itself to tracer studies. So we're going to defer to the TAC.
Okay, great. All right, so I think I'm going to ask Tom or Javier to restate the motion because there's at least one change, and then we'll ask for the board to make a motion. So that, I guess, restate the staff recommendation.
Okay, well, we recommend adoption of the revised tentative order with the two changes agreed that we requested that we agree with. And if you'd like, Javier, summarize them one more time.
Yep, just for the record.
So on page 17, provision six.
It's good to be specific.
Under bullet C, after page 17, provision six, sub-bullet B, following the work plan shall also, following that statement, it should be revised to state, include a schedule for completing the special study and submitting the final report for the special study, which shall be submitted to the executive officer for approval within 4 years of adoption of this order. That's the first revision. The second revision is on page 17, provision 6, first paragraph on the page, first sentence within the management question. And we recommend that it be revised to, does oyster shell harvesting affect shell transport and thus contribute to erosion of shell beaches and shoals in South Bay through interruption or loss in net sediment transport and sediment budgets that maintain bars and beaches?
Is this at the top of page 17?
Yes.
So the main paragraph at the top of 17.
On the second line at the top 17, midway through the second line where it says, does oyster shell harvesting, right after the colon.
Yeah. And then you added those sentences.
Then we added, essentially, it would revise, does oyster shell harvesting affect shell transport and contribute to erosion of shell beaches and shoals in the South Bay? It would revise that question to read, does oyster shell harvesting affect shell transport and thus contribute to erosion of shell beaches and shoals in South Bay through interruption or loss in net sediment transport and sediment budgets that maintain bars and beaches?
Thank you, Javier. Okay, I think we've got all that. So can I get a motion from a board member? Oh, Jim?
I would move, I get to do this since you're...
Yeah, go for it.
I would move the staff recommendation as modified with the two changes that were just read into the record.
Wonderful. And a second?
I'll second.
Great. And we'll call the roll, please.
Aye.
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 Aye. And you get to say, so ordered. Thank you. That finishes item 6 and brings us to the main item of the show, but not an action item, which is... I needed one. All right. This is the proposed basin plan amendment on climate change. It is not an action item today. It is hearing only. And for members of the public here and in virtual attendance, we will be taking a break at lunch, roughly around 12, depending on how this goes, for a closed session on personnel matters. Christina Toms.
Whoa.
Nope. Yeah.
That's a little dark two. Even for me.
Isn't it two? It's three. I forget. It's been a while.
Yes, just for the record, well, Christina Toms will give the staff presentation on the item.
All right. Good morning, everyone. My name is Christina Toms, and I'm a senior environmental scientist in the Planning and TMDL division. I'm excited to present our proposed basin plan amendment on climate change and aquatic habitat protection, management, and restoration. We hope that this proposed amendment will be the first in a series that will help protect the region's waters from the effects of climate change. Today, we'll first present the purpose of the proposed amendment, then project planning efforts to date. And finally, the majority of the presentation will describe the elements of the proposed amendment. The Water Quality Control Plan for the San Francisco Basin, or Basin Plan, is the Water Board's master water quality control planning document. The purpose of this proposed non-regulatory amendment is twofold. First, it will update the basin plan to include information on how climate change impacts water quality. And second, it will update the basin plan to include information that may be useful for the planning and permitting of projects in coastal waters. It's important to emphasize that the proposed basin plan amendment is non-regulatory and does not promulgate any new policies or requirements. We have pursued this path for multiple reasons. First, the proposed amendment furthers our collaborative efforts with the regulated community and partner agencies on permitting coastal projects, especially climate change adaptation projects. Moving forward, we want to use the information we gather to further inform the need for a potential future regulatory basin plan amendment. Second, it supports our goal of being a transparent regulatory agency by documenting questions that we may already ask permit applicants. Third, the proposed amendment is meant to be informative and adds information to the basin plan that may be useful for permitting. Next, we'll go through the process that got us here. Updating the basin plan to include considerations related to climate change has been a priority of the board since 2015. That same year, the California Coastal Conservancy and its partners, including the Water Board, released a science update to the Baylands Ecosystem Habitat Goals. This update highlighted the need to accelerate the restoration of connected, complex Baylan habitats by 2030. In 2018, the Water Board held a series of workshops to discuss our wastewater and fill policies within the context of climate change. In 2019, the San Francisco Bay Shoreline Adaptation Atlas was released, funded by the Water Board and prepared by the San Francisco Estuary Institute, an urban planning nonprofit SPUR. The Adaptation Atlas describes a science-based framework for where natural and nature-based climate change adaptation approaches can support resilient, built, and natural communities along the margins of the bay. Later that year, we released a staff report that described a suite of options for amending the basin plan to address the challenge of climate change. In 2021, we held a CEQA scoping meeting to define the scope of environmental analysis in our substitute environmental document. The basin plan amendment that I'm about to describe builds upon all of these past efforts. Our proposed changes to the basin plan include a new section in Chapter 1, the introduction, that describes the influence of our changing climate on the environment through increases in global temperatures, sea levels, and the timing, intensity, frequency, and duration of extreme weather and climate events. These changes impact water quality through multiple mechanisms, including through drought and heat waves that can desiccate streams and drive catastrophic wildfires that change patterns of sediment delivery in watersheds. Oops. You're not supposed to do that. Sorry about this, we're having technical difficulties. Oh, here we go, hold on. There we go. Extreme storms are causing more severe floods, especially in areas where tidal drainage is limited by rising sea levels. Climate change is driving ocean acidification, hypoxia, and more frequent and widespread harmful algal blooms, with subsequent shifts in aquatic species composition. Rising seas can also drive the rise of nearshore groundwater, which can in turn drive saltwater and vapor intrusion, and the mobilization and spread of pollutants in groundwater. As these photos illustrate, the Bay Area is already experiencing many of these impacts, and the best available science tells us that these impacts are expected to become even more severe and widespread in the future. The heart of our proposed basin plan amendment is in a new section on climate change and aquatic habitat protection, management, and restoration. It proposes a series of questions that may be helpful for permit applicants and water board staff who want to integrate climate change into their decision making. These questions are based on science in the Habitat Goals Reports, Adaptation Atlas, and related technical resources that emphasize the importance of long-term, landscape-scale, nature-based approaches to climate change adaptation. Consider a metaphor using the sublime water-themed quilts of celebrated Palo Alto artist Linda Gass. Think of our region's coastal landscapes as a quilt with different colored patches representing different habitats such as open water, wetlands, mudflats, and beaches. Climate change threatens to turn these complex, dynamic, colorful mosaics of habitats into a simple, static, almost monotone canvas. But if our region collectively takes a thoughtful, long-term approach to climate change adaptation that emphasizes complex, connected nature-based solutions, these habitats and the plants, wildlife, and people that depend on them can adjust and move into new locations and configurations. Over time, the landscape can evolve into a new quilt, one in which the patches of habitats are arranged differently, but with similar proportions and distributions across the whole. This new section of the Basin Plan proposes a series of questions that Water Board staff and permit applicants may find helpful to consider reasonably foreseeable conditions from climate change and related factors in project permitting. I'll describe these questions over the next five slides. The first question that may be helpful asks, is the proposed project design, as well as assessment of its near-term and long-term impacts at site and landscape scales, based on the best available science describing climate change and its influence on the environment? Starting from the upper left and moving clockwise, this slide highlights the California Sea Level Rise Guidance, Habitat Goals Update, Sediment for Survival Report, New Life for Eroding Shorelines Report, and the Adaptation Atlas. The amendment asks this question because projects should be based on the best available science that describes anticipated future conditions over the life of the project. The resources shown here and their supporting technical literature are examples of the many helpful starting places for decision makers seeking the best available science on reasonably foreseeable changes in sea levels, seasonal precipitation, watershed runoff, salinity, nearshore groundwater levels, wave events, and sediment supplies. The second question that may be helpful asks, is the proposed project designed as part of a phased adaptation strategy that anticipates future projects and accommodates these projects in a manner that protects future beneficial uses of the site and its landscape? This slide displays a conceptual example of a phased adaptation strategy, which can help decision makers identify a sequence of actions that provide gradually increasing levels of flood protection over time based on predetermined thresholds of sea level rise instead of arbitrary timelines. In the example shown on the slide, initial actions that build beaches and recharge local sediment supplies buy time for later actions that prepare adjacent landscapes to support the sea level rise driven transgression of habitats inland and upslope. These approaches can accommodate uncertainty about the timing and severity of climate change impacts and allow for flexibility over time. The third question that may be helpful asks, is the proposed project designed within a landscape scale cross-jurisdictional framework, such as an operational landscape unit? The effects of climate change aren't limited by traditional political boundaries, such as parcels, cities, and counties. The Bay and Pacific Ocean are interconnected systems, and what happens along one portion of a shoreline can affect other portions of a shoreline. Therefore, it's important for projects in shorelines and coastal waters to be planned and implemented in a spatial framework that accounts for this connectivity. The Adaptation Atlas does just that by classifying the entire bay shoreline into 30 operational landscape units that cross traditional political boundaries, but adhere to those of natural shoreline processes such as tides, waves, and sediment movement. OLUs and similar cross-jurisdictional frameworks can support planning for projects that minimize cumulative impacts across a landscape and allow habitats to adjust in response to climate change. The Water Board is currently funding the San Francisco Estuary Institute to develop phased adaptation strategies like the one described in the previous slide for the Bay Point Operational Landscape Unit along the northern shoreline of Contra Costa County, as well as the San Leandro Operational Landscape Unit in Alameda County. The fourth question that may be helpful asks, does the proposed project utilize practicable natural and/or nature-based design features, or a combination of traditional and nature-based features? Nature-based approaches and hybrid measures that integrate nature with engineered structural approaches can help create resilient shorelines that support co-benefits such as recreation and habitat for native species. They may perform better than traditional engineered gray infrastructure such as seawalls and riprap alone, and can cost less over time. Projects that maximize the use of nature-based features and minimize reliance on gray infrastructure generally have fewer cumulative impacts than projects that rely solely on gray infrastructure. The Basin Plan Amendment highlights nature-based approaches such as living shorelines, including projects to establish oyster and eelgrass habitat, beach creation, enhancement, and restoration, wetland protection, enhancement, and restoration, estuary watershed reconnection, in which flood control channels are reconnected to baylands, strategic sediment placement, in which dredged sediment is beneficially reused to help baylin habitats maintain elevation relative to rising sea levels, gradually sloped ecotone levees and wastewater seepage or horizontal levees that beneficially reuse treated wastewater to recreate freshwater and brackish marshes around the bay margins, and migration space preparation that facilitates the long-term sea level rise-driven transgression of estuarine wetland habitats over adjacent uplands. The fifth question that may be helpful asks, for a proposed dredge or fill activity, what are the near and long-term direct, indirect, and cumulative impacts to the acreage, functions, and values of waters of the state when considering the reasonably foreseeable conditions from climate change? This question includes a series of sub-questions that are meant to illuminate key, complex interactions between climate change, proposed dredge and fill activities, and landscapes, and the physical and ecological processes and conditions that affect all three across space and time. Identifying and understanding these interactions can help Water Board staff assess a project's potential impacts and reduce uncertainties related to the development of mitigation requirements and performance metrics. Informational resources, such as those I described under question one, can help answer these questions and support science-based decision-making by the Water Board. This series of sub-questions can be broadly grouped into four categories: environmental drivers, the impacts of taking no action, coherent landscapes, and type conversion. Under environmental drivers, the sub-questions are, what are the primary hydrologic, geomorphic, and ecological drivers of beneficial uses and habitat resilience at the site and landscape scale? And how are they likely to influence the landscape in the near and long term? Where and how are processes such as upland migration or transgression, erosion, progradation, accretion, and/or drowning likely to impact the condition, location, and distribution of different habitat types? And how might the proposed dredge or fill activities influence these drivers? Under impacts of no action, the sub-questions are, how would the affected landscapes be likely to evolve in the absence of the proposed dredge or fill activities? And given the likely range of anticipated environmental drivers, would the absence of the proposed activities likely result in less diverse, resilient, or complete habitats in the long term? The photo here shows how Surfers Beach in Half Moon Bay is completely submerged during high tides, periods of large sustained swell, and other high water events. The combined effects of coastal development and sea level rise have created a scenario where, without intervention, the beach could be underwater under most future tidal conditions. Under coherent landscapes, the sub-questions are the proposed dredge or fill activities geographically and geomorphically situated and designed to work with both site scale and landscape scale natural processes, such as the movement of water and sediment, shifts in plant communities, and the movement of fish and wildlife between different habitats? Will the proposed activities enhance or impede the ability of these natural processes to exert work on the landscape? This graphic from the 2015 Habitat Goals update illustrates the concept of the complete marsh, the tidal wetland landscape with connections to habitats above, below, and between the tides. The science in this and related documents is clear that landscapes that are connected to the physical and ecological processes that sustain them are more biodiverse, productive, and resilient to climate change. Under type conversions, the sub-questions are, does the landscape setting, including local climate, hydrology, sediment supply, degree of urbanization, habitat connectivity, and geomorphic setting support the intended habitat type? Does the intended habitat type require intensive management that will have to be funded and implemented in the long term? What ecosystem functions will be gained or lost through type conversion? And what is the potential timing and magnitude of these changes? How are these changes likely to influence ecosystem functions within the broader landscape? And is the proposed type conversion consistent with strategies developed by collaborations of stakeholders to achieve regional goals such as recovering rare and/or historic habitat types, improving landscape activity and complexity, or supporting long-term habitat resilience? These questions are largely based on the aquatic resource type conversion framework developed by scientists at the Southern California Coastal Water Research Project with input from the Water Board and funding from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Finally, the non-regulatory basin plan amendment also proposes a number of editorial changes to update references, correct errors, and make minor non-substantive edits for clarity. These changes include updating the references to technical documents that can be used to designate the beneficial uses of wetlands in the region and support wetland restoration and mitigation planning. These references include the documents previously cited in this presentation, in addition to the San Francisco Estuary Partnership's Comprehensive Conservation and Management Plan, or Estuary Blueprint, and the Bay Area Aquatic Resource Inventory and Associated Data Visualization Platform, EcoAtlas. These reports, data sets, and tools, as well as their supporting technical literature, can be useful informational resources for permit applicants and Water Board staff. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any clarifying questions.
So let's bring it back to the board and look for questions. I'll start on my left. Bill, did you have any questions? Andy.
Oh, this is like Andy goes to the candy store. First of all, thank you, Christina. This is a superb presentation. I just want to, I mean, the skills you just displayed of not talking to me while I'm trying to read a paragraph on the screen and animating the material on screen, so I'm only looking at the stuff I need to look at to follow what you're saying. It was just superb. Thank you so much. I was just so easy to listen to. I've got several questions. I'm really, really excited by what I think I understand to be the leadership that our organization is showing here. So the first of all, you guys worked with the San Francisco Estuary Institute to create this concept of the operational landscape unit. Okay. And I am seeing this appear in presentations at BCDC, and it seems to be, people seem to get it, like it's the proper scale. It gets the right people around the table, it convenes people. And so, and as far as I can tell, this will be the first time that it has been integrated officially into our basin plan, our documents. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Great. I think that's wonderful. And I wanted to ask about section 1.7 and about the statement about climate change. Like, here's the reality we face, basically. Okay, so has that reality been shared with other agencies? Does that reality draw on some kind of consensus, or would there be some debate about how we're framing the problem versus how somebody else might frame the problem?
So I think we're really fortunate in the state of California. We've had tremendous leadership at the state level to produce numerous documents that have not only laid out what we already know to be happening, what we already see happening on the landscape, but anticipated future directions. And I think in a lot of these cases, it's hard to know the precise magnitude of change, but we do see the direction in which things are going.
Yeah. Okay. So we're thinking along the same lines, say, as the Ocean Protection Council. And okay.
Yes.
That's great. How does then? Just two more quick questions. One, if I understand your statement about the what happens if we take no action, that is, I have seen that framed slightly differently, which is that the no action alternative is no longer the conservative choice. And is that what we're saying, is that if we don't take action, things are changing, so things don't stay the same. And that, to me, to encourage our applicants to think that way is fundamentally important and fundamentally different than how we've thought in the past about things. The last thing I have to ask you has to do with the relation to the ideas you're proposing and what BayAdapt has proposed. So that BayAdapt has, is there, was it 11 or areas, some questions, issues of which are, like people have said, the Water Board could be a great lead on this. And what I'm wondering, and I can't remember, maybe I should know this, sorry, but for those parts of BayAdapt, is what you're proposing here kind of fit in as advancing the thinking around those items that we would be the natural leaders of? That's right, I should be asking you, shouldn't I? Okay.
I'll answer that. I think the answer in general is yes, but BayAdapt is much, much broader.
Yeah, right.
So there's a lot more depth of concepts and technical discussion and protections related to our authorities here than is evident right now in the BayAdapt actions.
Right, but it's the idea that in general, that's all I could expect, but that really helps the region if we are taking these steps to help organize the debate and the thinking in the future. Let me just say, I think you guys did a remarkable job with a very difficult topic. And thanks a lot.
I'd like to just quickly build on that theme, that by presenting this information in the basin plan and in the matter we have, it draws attention to the leadership role the board can and does play in an articulate manner, so that we can avoid any confusion. So I like the concept as illustrated in the presentation about the transparency that we get from this, as well as a calling out our ability to lead in a collaborative manner in our role working with other agencies as well as project proponents.
Absolutely. And I, sitting where I sit now and thinking back, say, Tom, to 1986 when we were doing an analysis of the first study of loading of trace metals to San Francisco Bay, and the idea that pushing forward with the information we have helps identify questions we can study in the future and can clarify how things are going. I'm thinking about Riley's presentation to us just a couple of months ago when we saw projects fully grown out that then survived floods that no one was sure they would really survive or not. But now we have that information. And it's just, so this to me seems like, again, we're expanding the foundation of something we know how to grow and develop so that in the future we will have knowledge that will become routine components of NPDES permits that will be leading to a future, and that waste discharge of crime is leading to a much more resilient future because we're organizing our thoughts now. So my hat's off to you guys. I think this has been a really great job.
Who dares follow that? Go ahead, Alexis.
Thank you for your hard work on this. I have a question on page 7, section 4.23.4. The second paragraph, the second line, what is our intent with the word import there? Because you've clearly shown us that what we're doing with underlines and strikeouts, but I didn't understand what was the intent of the words between the parentheses. Waters of the state are in parens. You want my copy?
We just want to make it clear that for dredge and fill activities, it's not just wetlands, but it's all waters of the state.
So are you adding that? I don't understand the parens, that's all.
Before the parentheses are struck out, before it said wetlands in parentheses, waters of the state, because wetlands are waters of the state. So what we did was we struck out the wetlands part and the parentheses, and it's just referring to the broader term, which is waters of the state, which includes open waters.
So that phrase would read to regulate discharges of waste to waters of the state, comma, including wetlands, comma.
Correct.
Okay. And then just a general kind of navigational question. If someone were, you know, if this comes back to us as you forecast time in June, if someone were to ask with regard to aquatic habitat protection projects, where do you send me the applicant with regard to monitoring and mitigation? Should there be directional arrows of where people go to find that information from us, or how does someone navigate that question?
We didn't touch monitoring and mitigation in this particular base plan amendment, so it would go back to some of the guidance in, well, not guidance, there's policy in the dredge and fill procedures that was adopted by the state board statewide. There's information there on monitoring and mitigation requirements. In addition, we strive to work collaboratively with all our permittees, especially folks working on restoration activities through the BRIT, Bay Regulatory Restoration Integration Team, and other venues. We actually work with them ahead of time to discuss monitoring and mitigation. The part that touches upon mitigation is the type change language that we put in there. And that's something that we're currently working on with the BRIT, the Bay Regulatory Restoration Regulatory Integration Team, to pilot and to see how well that works. And that would get at the mitigation. In most cases with type change, if they go through this process, it's really first a decision, is it the right place to do a type, change type? And then if it is, in theory, there's a benefit and there would actually be no mitigation. It would be a benefit.
I'd like to build off of that, but respond slightly different, Board Member Hacker, because I take your question as a welcome challenge to asking us to do something that we want to do, notwithstanding our resource constraints as we proceed from here on, is to enhance our communication on these issues. We're going to enhance our web presence, and we want to make to avoid the problems that we too often have found in the past where we get inadequate applications. People don't know what's expected. So it's we want to and intend to be more proactive and deliver tools or means to find information like you ask. That's
I'm a perfect segue, Tom. I just wanted to add in here, first of all, thank you for the great work. I don't know if you mentioned this, Andy. I was doing something for a second, but if the board recalls that we had set up a climate subcommittee many months ago, years ago, I don't know. And Andy and I were both on this and working with Lisa and the team. And so Andy and I got a preview of this the other day. And we also talked about whether it was time to closed down our little subcommittee, like sort of our work was done, yay. And as we started talking to Lisa, we realized that while we're so grateful and really pleased with everything that's been done, this communication aspect and the limited resources we have around communication is another big task in front of us. So it's great to do all this wonderful work, but if we can't get it communicated and get it out there in meaningful ways, it has limitations. So we're going to keep our little subcommittee for a little while longer and see what we can do to continue to support and shepherd the resources we need to be able to communicate it well. So anyway, thank you, and more to come.
Donald, any questions from you? I do have on my notes, and I did see in the audience, Cameron Carr as wanting to make some comments. So can we promote Cameron and give him a chance to comment, please?
Hi there. Can you hear me?
We can. Thank you. Go ahead.
Good morning. I'm Cameron Carr. I'm with the Bay Planning Coalition. And I want to start off by thanking Regional Water Board staff for taking the time to meet with us on April 6th to discuss the proposed basin plan amendment. Those in the business community still have unanswered questions about the Water Board's questions. And the Water Board staff will join BBC for a workshop next week on April 18th. To further discuss the proposed amendment and hopefully address our concerns. In closing, I would like to emphasize that the business community wants to be engaged in the discussions and major plans that may impact businesses in the Bay Area. And we appreciate Christina Toms and other staff members for working with us. And we are looking forward to the workshop next week. And that is it. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Cameron. Is there anybody else in the audience who wishes to address the board on this item? Can't get my machine to get me the attendees. I don't see another raised hands. All right. I didn't have any questions. I do have a quick comment. Tom, did you?
Yeah, just want to respect the fact that we actually received a letter. This is in advance of the comment deadline, so it's a sort of it's a first step. But it just reflects the testimony we just heard, because this is a letter sent by both the Bay Planning Coalition and the Bay Area Council, who were participants at this previous meeting that referred to, and this letter just recognizes that and calls attention to the forthcoming encounter we're going to have with them next week. And so that's pretty much just an informational letter. But I want to emphasize, and we brought this up in our first encounter, and we'll continue to emphasize in our subsequent encounters, is that this type of reaction is exactly what we were hoping to get. We want to know, that the business community is looking at this possibly more as more of a regulatory play than we are asserting, because anything that can affect getting a permit is of a concern. Anybody pursuing a permit's logical. But where we're trying to be clear is that this doesn't create anything, any new authority. It just communicates how existing authorities can be used. And what we, by not making this anything in here as a backstop that would have legal must do, gives us an opportunity to ground truth. What are the things that work? What are the things that may not work so well? What are so with that lessons learned, then we'll be able to build a foundation for recognizing the good types of projects and the not so good, perhaps in the future in a more regulatory sense. But at this point, we can avoid unintended consequences, because there's no legal mandate that you have to live with the consequence. It would be vetted as we normally would vet anything through a project, but just gives us a higher level of transparency and explaining what the board's plan is for the future, rather than just project by project. So I look at it as tell us the concerns so we can make sure those concerns, especially those that are unintended, with unintended consequences, won't be realized? Or, well, what information do we need to make sure we don't find ourselves in those pickles? And this is an opportunity for us to lead through collaboration, regulate in a collaboratory fashion, which we know will pay off in the long run. So it's, I think, I expect this forthcoming meeting is going to be very productive along that line. And then our intention is, once board does fully consider this amendment, we will go into that mode of engaging in a constructive, collaborative manner. And just to be frank, I think the concern is when something like this happens, then staff theoretically would run amok and be overly zealous. And I can assure you, because the attention that we're going to be giving this at all levels of management, that won't happen. We're going to be promoting doing the right thing smartly, good science, good political science as well in what we work, what we pursue and permit.
I'd just like to add that the issues and that Christina Toms presented that are in this basin plan amendment were built in collaboration with project proponents and trying some things and learning lessons learned that weren't working and that were hurdles. So in collaboration with them and other technical experts and policy experts. So we've been at that a long time, came to this point, and now we'll continue to do that to refine and get this right so we can permit efficiently and get these projects in place protectively.
So a couple of comments. Having done beach nourishment projects and habitat creation on a scale when I was considered the Antichrist, and to hear much of what I said then that was controversial become common wisdom is at least a little bit gratifying. This is done right. It's done right by the board subcommittee, small enough so that it didn't run afoul of what we can do, but to create the relationship between the board and the staff. My only real complaint is the name Operational Landscape Units. It's just not. It's the opposite of sexy. It's like, oh my God, my eyes are glazing over. But no, really, this is the collaborative approach that we've come to expect out of our staff. It has legs because you're seeing it from BCDC. And just to note the difference between collaboration, I was the main representative of this board to BCDC when the climate change proposal that they put together blew up, and I spent many days in negotiating sessions putting the genie back in the box and bearing a certain amount of responsibility for what came across as more aggressive than smart. So very good work. It does what I think is really important. It provides the guidance out there. And one cautionary note for Bay Planning Coalition, that this is not a mechanism, as I read it, to ask for perfect. And I think about this with a site like the Berkeley Marina, which will eventually be underwater, almost all of it. It's not clear how much can be saved, and it's not clear whether or not the asset value at some stage is enough to be saved. But you don't walk away from an asset that has 70 more years or 40 more years. You use your assets. So that thinking, I think, is certainly implicit in my approach to management. And I think the collaborative approach that looks at resilience over time, as was outlined here, provides a mechanism for that. So I thank you for that, and I applaud you for that. So, Tom?
Yeah, I wanted to make a pitch for our let you know that our efforts are being recognized nationally. And so this is somewhat of a compliment to the reputation Christina is getting, but I want to point out that she's going to be participating on a panel being sponsored by the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine, focusing on Earth and Life Sciences. It's a forum, ongoing forum called Climate Conversations. So it's a national forum she's going to be participating on. It's free for anybody who wants to engage in it. And if you just You just have to search for climate conversations and you'll usually find a website that allows you to register. So just, you know, part of the challenge that we have with Christina is that a lot of other people want her attention. And but this is shows that we are getting recognized that for our work.
When is that?
Oh, excuse me, I didn't say that. It's Thursday, April 21, and it's 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern time, so it'll be noon to 1 p.m. our time.
On the
20th. Week from tomorrow, April 21.
I am just about to say you want.
Yeah, our good friend Jim Hausner brought this to our attention this morning.
Can I just remember one question I wanted to ask, which is the pictures you were showing of projects, I recognize most of them, right? Because they're all just starting to get going. But like Aramburu Island, for instance, now Aramburu Island's been there for 6 years, 7 years? Right, okay. So do we regionally have a mechanism in place to track and understand the performance of these that would then feed back into thinking about a project coming before the water board? Are we, I guess what I'm asking is, do we have a regional way to learn?
So it's just over 7 years for the record, Rambler Island. And then currently we're working collaboratively with San Francisco Estuary Partnership and San Francisco Estuary Institute, as well as EPA, to establish a wetland regional monitoring program. At this time, what you're asking does not exist, but I'll turn it over to the head of the TAC of the Wetland Regional Monitoring Program, Christina.
Thanks for bringing that up, Board Member Gunther. So the WRMP, the Wetland Regional Monitoring Program, is an attempt to establish a regional monitoring framework so that instead of taking a postage stamp by postage stamp site-specific look at how these projects are performing, that we really zoom out and look at these projects on a regional scale and not only understand how the projects are performing, but how they're performing within the broader context of climate change. So we have a science framework that's based on looking at these projects and also looking at reference systems across space and time. And this has been attempted a number of times in the past. This current iteration of the WRMP is a collaborative effort that involves all of the major resource and regulatory agencies in the region. It involves the project funders, it involves NGOs, it involves the members of the public, the EJ community. And there's a collective hope that this mechanism, we just received a first round of implementation funding from the San Francisco Bay Restoration Authority. We also received a third round of planning funding from US EPA. So there seems to be a collective acknowledgement that there's a real need for this program. And so we're beginning to build it bit by bit and piece by piece. And we expect that over the next couple of years, we're going to, as we begin to implement this project, we'll really build that momentum and begin to answer questions like what you just asked.
Okay, but for me, like so the WRMP has been in development for, I mean, a long, Josh Collins has been talking about this for a long, long time. And I applaud where you've gotten to. What it proves not is any kind of incompetence on the people involved, but how long it takes to get the cats organized and get people thinking. But now here you are showing us actual changes in the landscape. And we know that this landscape, we're going to have to change our landscapes faster and faster. Because there's things going on, and I think about like Roger's project, which you showed, you know, and I know Roger went through three different mechanisms for how to get the mud out there, slinging it with a backhoe and on, and he came up with this pushing it off the top with the bulldozer. And so is that, and how we can we, are we in a place to transfer that information to other flood control districts who are dredging out their channels and want to do something positive with the material they have?
So yes, we actually work with BAFPA, with the Bay Area Flood Protection Agencies Association, And we meet with them monthly, Keith Lichten, the head of Watershed Division, and myself. And we talk about just these sorts of things and what can be done where and how and why. And so, and there's a lot of tech transfer in that forum, as well as through some other forums, such as Charge, when it's recharged and up and running again. But we sort of help to be the glue that helps to keep them talking, because they come to us and they ask us, you know, well, what can we expect? And, you know, with climate change and the uncertainties, you know, how can we approach this? And so we talk to them about, you know, what exactly can you do with this, with this uncertainty? And something that Christina said, you know, we may not know the magnitude, but we certainly know the direction. And so there are things based on just the direction that we can think about in order to adapt flood control projects and sediment. We're currently looking at a sediment strategy where we look at sediment within flood control channels and what can be done with that. You know, it may not make sense for Zone 7 to ship that all the way to the bayfront, but maybe there's gravel augmentation that it can be used for farther up in the watershed that keeps it in the system and also as a benefit to spawning for salmonids and such.
Right. So it's the institutionalization of this knowledge that where I'm going. I mean, our agency benefits from having staff of incredibly long tenure, but you get to these points where this knowledge resides between the ears of one person, and that person gets called and they dispense the knowledge, and that improves a project. And so it's a matter of how can we get beyond that so that we are assured that this, all the work that we're doing is allowed to go forward. And I don't expect an answer to that now, but it's certainly an important issue. I think the regional monitoring program in the Bay has, through its special studies and its annual workshops, and really set up a process that allows for that community scale learning going forward.
I just make one comment that's the BRIT, the Bay Regulatory Regulation, that helps with the cross different agencies. And then internally, we have our own climate action team that works across divisions. And then within my division, we have the climate change and TMDL section. So we're trying to make sure that we have multiple people working on these challenges so that any one person leaves, there's still institutional knowledge left in place. So all these things are all in the process, and you're absolutely right. Creating that institution is difficult, but we're working on it.
Awesome. I'm going to say thank you again for all the great work and more leadership coming into this field. So glad to hear it. I think we're ready to adjourn, and I'm so excited that Jim's here.
Actually, it's not adjournment. You're going to go into closed session.
We're going to go into closed session. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to go into closed session.
And then you're going to...
No, there's no action.
Yeah. So you're going to closed session. I understand you're going upstairs, and then you'll...
I think we're going to stay here.
Are you going to stay here? Okay. Yeah. And then after you're done with closed session, you would go back into open session to adjourn.
Okay. So we're going to go into closed session. Thanks, everybody. Do I need a motion? Nope. After the closed session.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, everybody. If you're